Hello and welcome to the Tree Planters podcast for February 2022. It is Margaret and Adam here, and this month, what are we talking about, Margaret?
Well, it's kind of just like one of our usual things. We've got a few bees in our bonnets about housing affordability, about sprawl, about community building, about how that plays into the election, how that plays into climate goals. I mean, you never know what you're going to get with us, but I think that's kind of the broad scope, I would say.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you sort of listen to anything that we've put out there before or read any of our stuff or have really any sort of familiarity with anything that we do, you'll know that we are really interested in how land use intersects with climate and the environment. And I mean, even the genesis of our little organization here, the Simcoe County Greenbelt Coalition, that was, you know, with the consultations the previous Ontario government was holding with the public around expanding the Greenbelt, and the Greenbelt being a land use policy. And as environmentalists, we thought and still think that the Greenbelt is a really excellent policy tool that limits unsustainable land use patterns and promotes more sustainable land use patterns. And specifically there, the unsustainable land use patterns that it limits are, for the most part, sprawl. And so there's a general understanding of sprawl out there. I'd say most people, if you say urban sprawl or just simply sprawl, they'll kind of have a vague sense of what you're talking about. They'll go to, suburbia, single family homes, car oriented development, car reliant development, really, you know, so development where you need a car in order to be able to access basic amenities. These are, and I'm looking out my window here because I live in such an area. These are, houses typically with two garage doors. They're usually sort of four bedrooms, a couple of baths, bathrooms, that sort of thing, driveway. There's parks sort of scattered around with playgrounds in them. Usually a sidewalk, at least one, on the larger roads. There's usually two on either side, but on the residential roads, there's usually just one. There's schools, almost on like a neighborhood level, and grouping a few dozen of those neighborhoods or maybe more together, then you're getting sort of secondary schools. And then at key intersections, large intersections, usually there's a cluster of commercial area where there's a grocery store, a drugstore, and that sort of thing, some fast food restaurants, gas station. So that, for me, in my mind, that's always sort of been what urban sprawl means. But I think what we're interested in exploring today is something that's a little bit different. And you already sort of hinted at it, Margaret. What was the term that you used? Did you say tall sprawl?
Vertical sprawl or tall sprawl, something that vertical. They talked about. And I think that's where you have to look in. Like, if you look at sprawl, like urban sprawl is primarily car dependent, right? Then it's hard to imagine how you could claim tall buildings or sprawl because it's no longer car dependent. But I think what is probably a more effective way to look at it is efficiency. The efficiency of the building design, not only in how much it costs the municipality to service, but also the efficiency of land and the efficiency of externalities, right? What it costs to do those sort of things. And one of those externalities is the health of the people that are in it and the social cohesion of the people that are in it. So urban sprawl, like we would think of, like those far-flung suburbs where, you know, because everybody drives, you don't have to live and work in the same place, you can drive wherever, has similar inefficiencies to very tall buildings when it comes to health outcomes, social cohesion, servicing efficiencies. And that's why some use that term.
Yeah. So I have some points on that as well. I know, like, before hitting the record button, we were talking a little bit about both wanting to focus on that particular aspect of it. I just want to rewind a little bit real quick and give sort of the proper definition of urban sprawl, though. So is defined as the spreading of urban developments, such as houses and shopping centers, on undeveloped land near a city. And then it continues, urban sprawl has been described as the unrestricted growth in many urban areas of housing, commercial development, and roads over large expanses of land, with little concern for urban planning. And that last little bit there, I think, is a little nugget of gold that I think if you were to sort of look at everything that we're going to hopefully address today in totality, that all has to do with this notion of planning. And when you're planning, really what you're doing is you are, or should be doing anyways, is you should be thinking about what the desirable outcome is. What are you trying to do? You know, what do you want to make happen? What are you fostering? What are you nourishing? What are the foundations that you're laying? Mm-hmm. What are they going to enable, be built on top of them? Mm-hmm. So, and I really question whether, like, the extent to which a lot of planners actually sort of think about that first and foremost. I think that they're actually almost given their marching orders before they even have a chance to get there. And then basically what a planner is required to do from then on is just figure out how to make it work.
Well, so let's be honest. Why would we expect anything different when our whole system is built on the extraction of wealth at the expense of people? I mean, our mm-hmm. whole economy is based on our GDP. There is not one thing within our GDP calculation that focuses on the well-being of people, mental, social, physical, emotional. That's not a thing. So although I agree with you with planners don't have that outcome in mind, nobody has that outcome in mind in general, right? Like, there's not a government that's saying, okay, let's stop talking about housing starts and real estate transactions and how many units and how much money we contributed to the economy based on all of these metrics. And let's start thinking about, are people healthy? Are they, you know, living in communities that are good for them? Are our kids okay? Like, that is not the primary question. That comes many, 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 if it comes at all, it comes many layers down past, oh, we have a building that we'd like to build. Mm-hmm. And then they go, why are the people so ticked off about this building? We don't understand. Because the people are thinking first about, how does this actually make my life better? And sometimes, you know, it's a lack of education, right? There is some NIMBYism to it in some cases. People are thinking, how does this actually make my life better, more affordable and healthier? And the governments are thinking, yeah, that's not really our concern. That's not what the policies tell us to do, right? Mm-hmm. Sorry if I'm jumping ahead, but I just don't want people to think, oh, urban sprawl really isn't my thing, because all I really want to get into is a place that I can afford. And afford economically is one thing why you should be caring about sprawl. But affording physically, environmentally is a whole other thing that isn't really talked about.
Yeah. Well, NIMBYism is a really fascinating topic. I think it's thrown out there in really sort of careless ways. We could do a whole episode and then some on
NIMBY
that.
NIMBY versus YIMBY. So,
yeah. Well, often, I mean, that there's a really interesting distinction there, I think, because a lot of so-called YIMBYs, yes, in my backyards, so it's actually not their backyards. Whereas NIMBYs often, I think it is more, typically it's more personal. And this isn't to say one is right or one is wrong. I just think that there's an important distinction to be made there. Mm-hmm. But I find NIMBYism fascinating because it is extremely emotional, and YIMBYism often, I mean, it can become emotional, but I think it's first and foremost a more sort of theoretical or academic, you know, usually it's more, I think more reasoned anyways, you know, it's recognizing that there's a need for this and, you know, trying to figure out how to make it work. Anyways, I find NIMBYism fascinating because it's, if you think about the emotionality in there and where that comes from, it's people feeling like their well-being, their livelihood perhaps is under threat. So mm-hmm. the, you know, in our society, and as you were sort of just pointing to, the vast amount of people's wealth is bound up in their homes. And it's that way for a reason, right? It's by design.
It's a commodity. And
it's a commodity. And the, what I find interesting is the way that we have planned our communities has enabled NIMBYism, right? It's like, and so a lot of urbanists, you know, they throw this term out there very sort of without, I think, recognizing the fact that there's a deep history of planning and poor urbanism, for lack of a better term, right? There's a history of development that has created this dynamic that they are a part of. And there just doesn't seem to be much willingness to address that dynamic, other than sort of just to throw out this term and kind of belittle people who have this emotional connection to their home that they don't want to. I mean, change is, we're hardwired to be fearful of change. Fearful is probably not the word, but to be cautious of change.
Yeah.
You know, so there's really fascinating dynamics there. I really do think that our communities need to change profoundly, the way that we build them, as I know you do too. But I just think that this dynamic, the YIMBY versus NIMBY, is not really a helpful one. And that's my two cents on that. But we're totally getting sidetracked, as we usually do.
I wanted to add on to that.
Okay. No, you respond. And then however badly I want to respond to your response, I will not, and we'll move on.
Okay. So there's two things I want to address about the NIMBY-YIMBY thing. First is that it's being set up as this generational warfare, right? The older people are squashing the younger people from getting homes, and the younger people are looking, you know, there's this animosity that's being fueled further by governments going, well, what are we going to do? These people don't want it. You guys do, like, you figure it out, right? And I don't think necessarily that either side is really far off of what they want to see happen. They want to have a community that's more participatory. They want to have a community that's more, you know, something where they feel that there's a role for them. But because we're still focused on the number crunching and then what's the density and what's this and blah, 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 the policy level of it, it just sets up, well, you know, if you have a problem with getting a home, it's these old people that keep doing all of this NIMBY stuff that are your problem. And that's really an easy scapegoat for politicians to get at, right? We're going to punish these old people, generally, is how they these established people, for being the problem why you can't get a home, forgetting that they've, you know, have turned housing into commodity, forgetting that they have underfunded public services where some people that want to move out of their home can't because there's nowhere, there's no nursing home, there's no retirement home, there's no, they're setting it up where you're my enemy, you live in my community, you're the problem, and allowing that to, they're absolved of any responsibility, whether it be provincial or municipal. So I think that's BS first. And then the other thing I would say is about change. I think people need to understand the context of how we build is not something we've been doing for generations upon generations. We have been in an experiment of how we build our communities probably for about the last 70 years. This is not something that we've done forever. This is a blip in human history as far as how we build our communities. So what I was reading an article talking about was people are afraid of change, yes, But actually what we're trying to move towards is how we used to build communities before car dependence and that individualism that came with car dependence became the major focus. What we really want to do is go back to the communities, not necessarily the social context of it, but the community design of the 30s and 40s and 50s, right? Where you had small little centers, you could connect by rail, you could connect by buses. Like the transportation and transit systems were so much better considering, you know, the age and time that they were at than what we have now. So they're saying that what we should stop doing is try to make it sound like we're changing, we're making all these really big changes. And what we're trying to do is actually revert back to how we used to build communities. That is where we need to go back to, more dense centers where you have 7 to 10 stories, maybe where you've got schools with urban community, like all kinds of stuff. So those are my two big rants. I think that's important for the YIMBY side as well as the NIMBY side to understand. It's not about building up towers everywhere. I don't think you and I agree on, I don't think we agree with that, you know, there should be 40 story towers everywhere. I think what we're trying to say is we need to move back to the type of development that it was. And when you present people with that, they tend to be less upset because it feels familiar versus I've never experienced this before. I've never seen this before. Right.
Yes. Yes. Well, and picking up on that, how we are isolated from one another, you know, so we just all went, you know, through at least, well, through this experience in Ottawa. And I think I say that collectively because I think most of us, while we may not have been there, we were all probably pretty wrapped up in it as Canadians who are concerned about our country. And I think it's an interesting connection to make. And I've had this in my mind a lot with respect to urban sprawl and the way that we build our communities. Between the increasing polarization that's happening politically and the increasing alienation that we have, in terms of how we meet each other in our day-to-day life. So sprawl, we each have our little kingdom, effectively. You know, that's pretty much the model that it is built on. You have your house, and for the most part, actually, you know, even if you're going to a grocery store, you're not really going to public space. I mean, that's in, yes, there's parks suburbia, but the public space is all sort of use oriented. It's not happenstance. It's not a space that you inhabit so much as it is a space that you utilize for a particular purpose, which I think is an important distinction. But I had this experience where we used to live downtown Barrie I may have talked about this before on this podcast. I think I have. And you'll know where I'm going with this. We used to live downtown Barrie, and we lived in a neighborhood that was pretty marginalized in a number of ways. There were a lot of people who struggled with addictions, and you would see, we had our second son too, but he was only a couple years old when we moved out of there to where we are now. But you would see people in public space behaving in very different ways from you. And that would prompt a lot of questions from my son. Why are they behaving like that? What's wrong with them? And force difficult conversations for us. And conversations that to try and understand something that is different, typically you gotta explore it, right? There's a lot of nuance to that. You gotta step outside of yourself, and you have to grapple with somebody else's experience, somebody else's reality. And that in itself is a really important tool to have as a citizen of a society, being able to understand where other people are at. And I think the way that we are developing our communities, specifically sprawl in single family homes, the way that we have them now, makes it more difficult for that to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's a shared characteristic with vertical sprawl. Mm-hmm. That, and it's, I mean, it's studied. There's evidence to back that point up. I mean, some really sort of simple metrics that they use to sort of figure this stuff out is time to street. How long does it take the person to get from their home or the place where they live down to the street and down to that shared space? And in a high rise, that's longer. And that barrier, even though it might not seem like a big deal, even though it's maybe several minutes or something like that, cumulatively, that adds up to a pretty big effect that tends to happen on the public life surrounding these spaces. Mm-hmm. And when you're thinking about what, you know, back to this notion of planning and the question of what outcome are you trying to achieve with this, I think that's a big divergence with high rises, is that the goal of enhancing the public life of a community and building those bridges and building that social cohesion is kind of left to one side. There are other goals, and I think some of those other goals are laudable. I think they're good. You know, the question of, you know, intensification and reducing the amount of land that's devoted to the footprint, to the urban footprint, and these sorts of things, and increasing the tax base to be able to pay for public services in transit-oriented community and that sort of thing. I think those are good, but there's a trade-off, I think, that needs to be considered. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure how much that is being considered with some of these things. So, well, we'll tie this into the local scene in a little bit. You know, we're you know, in Simcoe County, there isn't a heck of a lot of high rises being built generally, but there are certainly in certain areas, and we'll get to that. But yeah,
I think what I would like to add to this part, and I always screw up your plans, so I'm sorry if I'm screwing up your plans, but I think the reason why Adam and I get onto these a bit of a soapbox is because we know that people innately understand community building. They just don't think about it when it comes to the choices that are made within our communities. So for example, if you were to imagine a classroom, okay, two classrooms, same students, same teachers, same amount of space. And you have one classroom that has, say, round tables. Let's not think about COVID times, okay? But either way past COVID times or pre-COVID times. And you had one classroom that had round tables, and you had four or five students at each table, and you had spots where you had a listening center and the kids could work collaboratively in groups. You know, that's the one kind of setup, right? The other kind of setup is little cubicles where the kids are kind of in their own little sphere. You know, they're there and they're working. And if you had to look at those two images, and hopefully I've given you enough to imagine, when you look at them, you get different feelings from both of those things. You start to assume that one type of setup has a different focus than the other. So for me, when I think about those round tables, and I used to be a teacher, so this was kind of the thing that we used to think about, was how you set up your tables, how you position the shared resources, how all of that is organized totally impacts what the kids do and how the community of the classroom functions. So you look at those collaborative tables and you think about kids meeting one another, problem solving, you know, kind of some shared responsibilities. You look at the other setup with individual cubicles and you think about individualism. They're probably not as social. They're probably not talking as much. It's probably much more serious. You know, maybe it's just more focused on efficiency. And so that thought experience, you take that out into our public realm. And what Adam and I are trying to say is when you have sprawl, it's very akin to that classroom where you've got your own little space. Okay. And everybody feels good because they can have their desk however they want it. They put their erasers in a certain spot and their markers. You could have your, you can arrange your desk as much as you want, right? And feel good about your little desk. But then you need to realize going out from that, what does that do to the fabric of the community? My grandparents during the war, they owned a little convenience store. They had two in the end, but they owned a like little, I don't know if it's a convenience store, but it used to be kind of a, you could get candy and you could get, you know, your basic needs and all that sort of stuff at their store. And so when my grandfather went to war, my grandma and my mom would tell me stories about how they would barter and trade with the milkman and the iceman and all the other people to try and make sure that they had what they needed and that they had credit for some of their people. And you know, like it was, there was more of a small community where you could say, I know you, you come into my store, I know that you're struggling. And so there was this whole dynamic. And I'm not saying this is a utopia, okay? I recognize that there were certain people that fared those times better than others. And I'm not trying to say that that there wasn't inequality in those times. I'm just speaking to the dynamic where you have communities that have pulled together because they know each other and they are socially responsible and accountable to each other. And you can't create that unless you know people, unless you understand and you stop seeing them as a, oh, he's right wing, he's left wing, you know, she's totally into this. And he's like, you know, their kids, you know, where their house is, you know, their dog name, like whatever. You can't, it's really hard to do that in a place where everybody has their own cubicle. And so we start to see this polarization, I feel, because we're not actually, our communities aren't set up for us to be bonded. They're mm-hmm. meant for us to be efficiently separated so we don't have to deal with other people's problems. And then the pressure with COVID or other times is that if you can't figure it out on your own, there's nobody there to help you, right? And that becomes a really challenging psychological, emotional burden because you don't, Walmart doesn't care if you pay your bills or not. They don't care if you need a, like a $10 loan to be able to buy groceries for your kids. That's not going to happen, right? So because we're not connected, I feel that it's like you're completely left on your own, or the feeling of you're completely left on your own because you don't have a neighbor that you feel comfortable going, hey, you know, we're really struggling. Do you have, you know, something or you know, someone's power is out. Like I'm lucky in our neighborhood, we do kind of have that, but there's a lot of neighborhoods where they won't. So I'm going to stop about that, but that's what I'd like to add.
Yeah.
For a wrench into everything.
No. It's a really good point. And a really key element of resilience is that dynamism that can happen, right? The flexibility, the elasticity of the community. And so I think what we're getting at here is that dynamism, it's not only confined to the social realm of interpersonal relationships, right? There's the environment, and that includes the built environment, the environment that we construct for ourselves. And this is another point about vertical sprawl is high rises. They're quite difficult to repurpose. Right. Well, I mean, once they're built, that's just kind of what they are.
And fix.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe we can go to this next is the problems of affordability in high rises. So there's a lot of cost associated with them in terms of like construction costs and things like that. But that difficulty in repurposing that built form in the future, it just forecloses on possibility. And, you know, that reduces that dynamic in terms of resilience. I mean, I think another part of it, which I think is an interesting difference between a high rise and like a mid rise, which I think we're probably kind of advocating here a little bit more, the missing middle, if you've heard of that term, it's bandied about a lot. Another interesting thing about vertical sprawl and building condos, these really large developments require a lot of financing behind them, a lot of capital to build them. And that is, there aren't many people, let alone institutions or corporations, that are able to swing that. So it limits these types of developments to a relatively few entities. And I think that dynamic is another interesting angle to this, which it's not a particularly democratic form of development. I mean, suburban development where you're building cookie cutter houses, it's on large swaths of land. All of that land is owned by a large corporation, and maybe you can speak to this, but these corporations are huge and they're horizontally integrated, or is it vertically integrated with other,
integrated all over the place.
They're integrated. Yeah. That dynamic isn't particularly different from this, like a smaller footprint, but a much taller, build out. And I think in terms of that resilience argument, you're having those missing middle developments, and I don't have anything to back this up. This is just sort of me sort of thinking it through a little bit, but it seems to me that those are potentially easier to access for builders that are not as large, which also then acts to disperse the benefits, the financial benefits, the profits or what have you, the rent among a larger portion of the population, which builds a healthier, a healthier local economy, ideally, because I don't think most of the developers are or should be considered local. I mean, some may be situated local, but for the most part, I think that they are at least provincial in scope, or maybe regional in scope, who knows. But anyways, that resilience argument, I think, extends in that direction as well.
Mm-hmm.
Did I just talk myself into a corner there?
I don't know, really. Did you? I think that I think you're right about the financial side of housing. And I think that people don't appreciate when these really large development, people understand, like with the TMX pipeline or with some of these big infrastructure projects, that they're like, oh, you might have seen a campaign that says, stop RBC or stop Scotiabank because they're the ones that are financing all this stuff. The same thing happens in housing developments, for large scale housing developments, not your mom and pa's necessarily as much, but those kind of big projects also involve some lending, right? So yeah. It's not that the banks are only involved when it becomes like a multi provincial pipeline. I mean, they're involved in a lot of different things. So that I think we should do away with the myth, and we were talking about earlier, about that construction is a ma and pa industry, right? Mm-hmm. We have this nostalgic view of, like, for example, my father-in-law was a custom home builder for decades, and he would build like maybe 5 to 12 homes a year, right? That isn't a thing anymore. I mean, there's still some people doing it, but generally that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about people that generally don't live in the area, don't have any affinity for the area. Sometimes will hire local trades, but a lot of times have their own crews that they move from place to place. It's almost like locusts in some ways. So I think it's not helpful to romanticize this idea of home builders, being quote unquote home builders. There's a commodification that has happened with it. And that old, I don't know if it's an old saying, but don't hate the player, hate the game. I mean, the game, the rules that have led to this, the priorities that we say are our priority, which is housing starts, GDP, supply have led us to this. And I was just speaking to a planner who's pretty well known before this call. And he was like, you know, if supply was the answer, he's like, the only way that supply is going to overall affect housing affordability is if you get to the point where you are oversupplying housing now. There are so many houses that you will not be, like, you will have a hard time selling your place. He's like, try to convince a developer to build in a market where there's an excess of supply. How many of them are going to say, oh, we're going to build 200 units. Most of them won't sell because guess what? We already have 10,000 on the market. And case in point, Barry just came out with a number that said about 19,000 units are ready to be built in Barry, have full approval, have not been built. So is supply the, you know, the vertical sprawl, everybody's like, oh, we're just going to build towers to build supply. And yes, probably supply, certain types of supply might be a bit of an issue. But I think we have to do away with some of these myths that it's only because people aren't building enough. If only, you know, developers were given more rights to build more as wherever they wanted, without red tape, without community involvement, we would get at housing affordability. And think about that. Think about how many houses would have to be built to drop the price of housing right now. What I think our average in Barrie is like 850,000 or something ridiculous like that. Like, how many houses would have to be built to turn that into affordable housing or more affordable housing, where now you're talking 600 or 500,000? How many houses would you need to drop your prices by 50%? Really? Well,
so the use of the supply demand dynamic in the housing market is extremely problematic, to say the least. The core ingredient of it is non-reproducible. It's a finite supply of land, right? You can't produce, you can't supply more land. Sorry, folks. I mean, you can expand boundaries and this sort of thing. So there's some elasticity there. But ultimately, the supply dynamic breaks down because there's a lack of supply that can be brought to bear in terms of land on the housing market. So that, I think a lot of people, I'm not an economist. I dabble, and I took quite a number of courses in university dealing with it, so I know a little bit about it. But that's a really key problem in this whole argument that supply, that all that increasing supply will drive down prices, because one of those, yeah, it's just not possible to actually increase supply in terms of land, right? You know, there's an old saying, I think it's probably mostly used by developers, which is, I don't know, buy land, they're not making more of it, or something like that.
Well, and in some cases,
invest in land, they're not making more of it.
And if you saw any of the climate maps that I think we released last week that talked about the rising sea levels, if you looked at Florida, like, not only are we not making any more, we're actually going to be losing a heck of a lot too. So I think that, you know, just to clarify for listeners, we're not saying that there isn't a need for supply. I mean, yes, there are people that are having issues with getting off of the streets and finding some sort of secure housing. There are people that are struggling students who need to have some flexibility, but there's this binary that we have within, we either go really tall or we go just spread like houses, like seeds out in the middle of green fields and just keep going as far as we can see. And that does not help with the affordability issue at all, because you need to be thinking about, like, I just did some statistics for Simcoe County about traveling, and they were really interesting about the percentage of people in Simcoe County that either are too young to drive or are probably on the verge of aging out of being able to drive. There's obviously those people that choose not to drive or can't afford to drive. But if you just look at the age percentage alone, you're talking roughly a quarter of the people in Simcoe County can't drive, right? Or likely not to drive, not including. So it's probably even higher than that by the time you add in poverty, by the time you add in people that are just choosing not to drive, right? So that means we are planning 3/4 of our population is based on the idea that you're going to drive. And that is not, that does not make housing more affordable by building up. And you've talked about this a lot. You are now assuming that when you get a house, you're going to need a car. So it's not just a house that they were building. We're actually, it's a house plus a car, because otherwise you're not going to get anywhere. You don't have a doctor nearby. You don't have a grocery nearby. You're going to have to be spending at least $10,000 a year in addition to whatever that house sticker is. And I think it's, I think in my, I'm just trying to see if I can find it, but the, yeah, here it is. The, it is, sorry, one second. There, something about the amount of people in Simcoe County that have three or more cars. Almost 25% of people in Simcoe County have three or more vehicles, right? Like
households?
Yeah, households. Sorry.
Okay.
That's
that's crazy. Yeah.
It's crazy. But yet, when you look at how many home to work trips are made, the most, the highest percentage is 30% of all home to work trips are under 5 kilometers. So it's amazing to me that we are continuing to say we need to address affordability by making sure people have a house and a car, because that's going to help them with affordability. Oh, and by the way, you have no daycare. Oh, and by the way, there's no community school anymore. Now your kids are going to be bused however long to get to the one high school or to get to the, like, it is going back to that classroom example. And I know I'm getting a little bit like worked up here because it just baffles me. If we go back to that thought experiment with the classroom, like we are not paying attention to the decisions that are being made about what our communities look like. And innately, even though we know how important those things are, we're being sold a bill of goods that says the cubicle is really good for you. I don't know why you don't like it. Everybody likes it. You get more, yeah, way more desks in if you stick to your little cubicle, right? Like, anyway.
Well, that's, I mean, that's certainly one. Well, before I actually, I just want to say real quick, on the point of the non-reproducibility of land supply, for all of those real estate brokerages out there who'd like to sponsor us, both of our email addresses are easily accessible. Yeah, so feel free. And
I'm sure that's where they're going to be contacting.
On that question of affordability. So that number of that figure that you attached to the ownership of a car, that $10,000, that's on average for Canadians. That's the cost of car ownership per year. That's a number that the CAA came out with in a study not too long ago. But that is also an argument in favor of intensification and transit oriented communities and potentially high rises. So, you know, that's one of the trade-offs, I think, that is worth considering. You know, if on balance, if you're looking at building on farmland, single family homes, you know, your typical suburban sprawl style development versus a condo, then where people don't need to own cars and there's amenities basically just outside of the front door, I think we'd probably be both arguing in favor of the condo development. But this is back to the affordability thing, though. So this is one of the interesting things that happens with high rises is above several floors in height, the costs per floor start to rise significantly. You know, and this is due to sort of really simple things like the amount of the increased labor costs, because it takes workers longer to get up and down. It's really simple, but then also just construction materials, the type of construction materials that are required are quite a bit more expensive.
Pumping of water and energy, wastewater.
The engineering is more complex, required to do those sorts of things. I mean, that on Billionaire's Row, there's this relatively famous story of one of the most expensive buildings in New York, where the toilets were overflowing. It was a total shit show, literally. Because the engineering couldn't get it right. But that's another thing. So if you're thinking about high rises as a solution to affordability, either that has to be strictly regulated, or what you're looking at is you're looking at a divergence in income in all likelihood, where certain units are going to be priced up to offset the downward price in other units, those affordable units.
I just want to challenge when we get into these binary options that governments give us, like, mm-hmm. well, we either do this or this. So if you don't want that, it's going to have to be this. Not only are we encouraging them to be non-aspirational and basically boring, we are encouraging them not to look at any other evidence or any other jurisdictions that say, actually, there's a third option, right? Like, or fourth or fifth or sixth. So for example, Ryerson City Building Institute, which is now defunct, but a while ago, looked at Mississauga, who needed to accommodate like 400 and some odd thousand people. And their plan was like high rise, high rise, high rise. Well, they went through, took the land inventory. All of that housing that they needed to build, which were going to put into towers, they were like, actually, you can put it into infill. You can put it into medium density stuff that is no more than 11 stories high. That was as high as it was, right? And I think it's interesting how we consider transit-oriented communities just based on density. And you talked earlier about vertical sprawl and how when you get higher up, how cost effect or how cost inefficient it is as you go up. But there's also studies that show once you get over about 7 to 10 stories, the percentage of time that those people come down to the lower level to mm-hmm. actually interact becomes less and less and less and less. And you start thinking about if you're on the 30th floor of a condo, how long does that take you? Never mind like safety and all of that other stuff that comes into it. So I think a transit-oriented community not only provides the density, which is mm-hmm. achievable. I mean, look at how many skyscrapers Paris has. I know people don't like us comparing ourselves to Paris because we're different and we're Canada and we can't do Paris. Well, you know, Amsterdam wasn't Amsterdam at one point, and Copenhagen wasn't Copenhagen at some point, and Paris wasn't always Paris. So there are lots of iterations of a city that we assume can't be us because they're already so far ahead. But it actually just requires a point in time that says we are done with the binary thinking of we need to either expand urban boundaries or we need to remove all of our green canopy and build towers. No, there are places, there are options that are affordable, that provide housing choices, like actual real housing choices. It should no longer be acceptable for any of us to say your housing choice is to either have a 3,000 square foot home that you're going to have to drive to or a 600 square foot apartment in a condo. Really? Mm-hmm. That is what those are virtually our housing choices now. And that's bullshit because mm-hmm. there are lots of places where you can actually say, maybe I want a laneway house. Maybe I want a rental. Maybe I want a four-bedroom condo. Maybe I want a stacked. Like, there are options, right? And so I would just challenge that idea that when they say to me, well, do you want sprawl or do you want a condo? I don't think I would say, yeah, I want the condo. I would say those are both shit options. And you need to be a little bit more creative because if you really care about the health and well-being of your people, if you really care about building transit-oriented communities, and if you really care about climate, then you would know that neither of those options are the best option, right? Hmm. Again, mm-hmm. off my soapbox.
No, well, hey, you're good at it. And I mean, as far as those options go, there's another interesting point here, which is that high-rises, they inflate the price of adjacent land, right? So mm-hmm. they actually act to increase, or well, they limit the options available for that adjacent land and the type of development that would happen there, the type of activities that would happen there. And, you know, that increases gentrification. It reduces diversity in terms of social experiences in those places, which I guess maybe is another way of staying gentrification. I don't know. You know, these are difficult places for mom and pop stores to operate, to maintain, to continue to be viable. And those are exactly the types of businesses that we want if we're going to have a healthy, mm-hmm. you know, resilient local economy. We want locally owned stores. But instead, what you get at the street fronts around these places, typically they're large large corporations that bring in stores. You get the Shoppers Drug Marts and the different chain stores and things like that. But then back to the affordability question and just to get into the sustainability question of these buildings and some of the problems associated there, that's another increased cost that comes with building higher. Typically, they are very difficult to build in a way that is energy efficient. So there's really a lot of reliance on air conditioning and heating, because typically there's a lot of glass used in these buildings, and glass is really poor insulation value. So they are not particularly sustainable at all. There's studies out of Vancouver, they show that high rises use almost twice as much energy per square meter as mid-rise buildings do. So that energy loss, that heat loss, there's kind of interesting things that start to happen when you think about back to these trade-offs again, when you think about these issues. So Barry has just come out with a final, I think, draft of their greenhouse gas reduction plan. A lot of it is focusing on, well, some, a lot, some of it focuses on the possibility of a district heating system. It's basically a centralized heating hub that disperses heat or energy to a district, to a larger area. And it draws that heat or energy from potentially a number of different sources. Barry does something really interesting with one of its wastewater plants, the one downtown. I believe it uses a lot of the off-gassing to produce energy, and that energy actually is used. I think it covers most. I don't think it covers all. Covers most of the needs of the plant. But that's an example of. That's a good use of that. But in other areas, that energy could be redistributed around the neighborhood, driving costs, driving energy use down. And that's done in a number of areas. Vancouver's one that's experimenting with those ideas. So if you look at also kind of the development that's happening in Barrie, a lot of it is high-rise stuff. There's a really fascinating graphic that was shared in a recent development a public meeting for development, and it is a 3D rendering of all the proposed high rises in Barrie. And there's quite a few, and most of them are kind of over 20 stories. One gets up to 41 stories, 38 stories. We'll share the link to this in the show notes. But in terms of that greenhouse gas reduction plan, if what you're looking at is energy efficiency and reducing that, I think you got to be really careful with the type of development that you're doing. And I think that there's a strong case to be made. Well, it's not just thinking that. I mean, the data backs it up. There is a strong case to be made that high rises are not energy efficient. They're not sustainable. It's not a sustainable built form, at least currently. So if your goal is to address climate change and become more energy efficient, I think you need to be really careful with the type of buildings that you're approving, the type of development that you're approving.
Well, that's problematic with the climate conversation altogether, because as I've said so many times, my favorite phrase is it's more than pipelines and polar bears. I mean, honestly, when are we going to start grappling with the idea that the systems of how we build our communities are primarily the driver of our greenhouse gas emissions? So it's the car dependence. It's the type of building. It's where we put it. It's what we lose in order to build the housing. How we interact as a society with the land and the water is the driver of our climate emissions. And as long as we want to keep tinkering on the edges of, well, if we just put in a heat pump here or there, and if we just, you know, adjust the building code so it's a little bit different, but we're still going to build whatever we want to build, wherever we want to build it, and fit people in however we feel in the sardine cubicles that we keep telling them there's their only option. I mean, I had this really interesting discussion with a woman from Greenpeace who was calling me because she wanted some money. which is fine. Mm-hmm. I support Greenpeace. I think they do wonderful work. And she was like, you need to help us make sure Justin Trudeau upkeeps the goals of Canada's climate, right? Like, we need to push him to make sure that the federal government does all that it can do, because if we don't push Justin Trudeau, we will not meet our climate targets. And I thought, yeah, partially that's true. And she said, so what do you think? And I said, well, A, I find that funding local movements is where it needs to be, because that is the level of community work that gets underfunded routinely. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these federal groups or provincial groups tend to have a much easier time making those inroads. But anyways, and I said 50% of our greenhouse gas emissions, and everybody's heard me say this before, comes from municipal decisions. So Trudeau, if he meets every single target, if he does everything that he's supposed to do, he really only has jurisdiction over 50%. I mean, mm-hmm. let's be honest. So I was like, so what I see is the idea of Canada meeting its targets based solely on just pressuring Trudeau. Let's forget whether we think he's ambitious enough or all of that. Let's assume he is really ambitious, everything that he's promised he's going to do. I don't believe we're going to meet our climate targets at all, because you know why? The provinces and municipalities still believe we're in the 1950s and 1960s, and we don't have to worry about tornadoes or increased flooding or wildfires, and we can just build tall, and we can build highways in the middle of wetlands, and we can continue to put people in cubicles so they can get to their houses and their cars, because none of it has any impact on climate. Because we don't want to talk about it. Because if we do want to talk about it, we're going to have to really systematically pull apart our whole economic system, which is based on GDP and not on our well-being. And so everybody else would rather just pass the buck. So anyways, she had quite a problem afterwards. She was like, I don't know what to do now. She's like, maybe I should volunteer. So tirade. No. And she was like, well, what do you think I should do? Who do you think I should be fundraising for? And I was like, where do you live? And she's like, Toronto. I said, well, I would look at community groups that are trying to ensure better neighborhoods, that are talking about intersectionality of climate and justice and community building. That is where climate work we can all engage in, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on the point of the economy and how it skews things, and we're going to wrap up here in just a couple of minutes.
Soon?
Yeah. So it's interesting, actually, that maybe this is a good example of something like that. Barrie does have a where am I here? I'm trying to find it. Okay, in urban design guideline for intensification, and it's a really interesting document. You can find it on their website, and I think it's particularly instructive if you look at the renderings that are included in it, and almost all of them are a handful of stories high with active street storefronts on the streets with you know, shops, cafes, what have you, and then above that there's residential, lots of greenery, lots of trees, lots of people walking, lots of people biking. There are, you know, there's roads for cars, road space for cars as well. And the guidelines specifically state set maximum allowable heights at 8 stories. Require a minimum building height of 2 to 3 stories. Require a minimum ground floor height of 4.5 meters. And that's particularly interesting, active ground floor uses in the intensification areas. So, you know, their urban design guidelines are very explicit. They are recognizing exactly what we're talking about, that mm-hmm. missing middle component. And I mean, again, back to these renderings, you look at these renderings and they're, it's like a modern version of Paris, right? With the whole sort of, it'll show sort of a streetscape, and on both sides, it's lined with these buildings that are several stories high, but no more. Lots of greenery, lots of pedestrian use. But it's interesting to see, and back to this 3D rendering that this developer presented in this information session, how development is actually proceeding in the city, which is high rises. It's not according to these guidelines.
Yeah. You know,
I've been pleased to see that there are more of these missing middle type developments happening, but they're not happening in a concerted way exactly. I mean, part of these guidelines also is looking at, like, these should be lining primary streets, built around hubs, transit hubs and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it's just interesting to see and the economic angle to it and the influence that particular actors and particular visions have in how our communities are built. It's a little out of whack. You know, it's not really in keeping with their own guidelines, it seems to me. And it doesn't, based on everything we've been talking about today, it doesn't really seem to be in keeping with what actually is the public good. You know, what I think would be done in that sort of service, that planning service of achieving something desirable in terms of the public's benefit.
Well, and I think that they're okay. So there's a bit of a hat tip to Barrie, because they were one of the first jurisdictions in our area region that started to put laneway housing as a right? That they just kind of opened it up. And that's a really great way for intensification. And then they got all kinds of backlash and they had to kind of scale back that kind of as a right. Right. So I think the thing that, so hat tip to them for doing it. And I also believe that they're on the right track, but the people in the community need to take some frickin' accountability too, because if every time it's like, we don't want sprawl and we don't want towers, but I don't want my neighbor building a laneway house and I don't want that parking lot taken over by a small apartment building, pick a fucking lane, people. Do you want... do you want housing in your neighborhoods? Yes or no? If you don't, then just come out and say it. But every time we kibosh one of these low rise options or mid rise options, the likelihood of us going with the two options we know are economically inefficient, are socially destructive and environmentally destructive becomes the option. Because you know what? They just have to push enough to get the tower to go from 40. And I start to wonder if developers are going, okay, we're going to go with a really egregious number like 65, but what we really want is 28. So we're going to go 65. Let everybody get like, oh my gosh, 65. That's crazy. Okay. How about 28? Oh yeah. 28 is way better than history. So I almost wonder if they're going in with a bit of a strategy now, because you just have to pull it together and get through all of those issues. And then you get your high rise how you want. So, you know, people, whether you're in Barrie or wherever you are, you need to pick a frickin' lane, because if you want your parents, if you want your kids, if you want to be able to retire somewhere within your community or age in place, we have zero flexibility. My mom lives with us. She's got dementia. My options for her are a retirement home at $7,000 a month, or waiting until she breaks a hip and putting her into a nursing home. There are no options for her other than just staying with me, which anybody knows as a caregiver, comes a point where you can't do that anymore. Why are there not, a house that's got a couple of PSWs that has older people living together? Like, why is that not the development style that we can consider for people so that there's actually options, right? And as we were talking earlier about these like consortium developers, we have made it so when we choose sprawl, whether it be taller on the the boundaries, we've made it so that local people actually can't invest in their community. They can't be community developers, because the bylaws and the financing you would need is ridiculous. There was a really good example of a community developer in Seattle. He had bought this like small little parking lot that was for four cars. Okay. And you figure like, that's not very big. He made seven units out of that. Right. And like, affordable housing, like, may not be cheap housing, but they're all micro units of like 300 or 700 square feet. And that was with four parking lot squares. That is a person who can actually say, I want to invest in my community and I can actually bring housing and personally benefit from it, not as a conglomerate, not as someone who doesn't live here, but I can make these things happen. But I mean, as long as people still want to get into this whole idea of, I just like our community the way it is, and I don't want any changes to happen, and I don't think housing should be here, it should be somewhere else, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, eventually, and we've talked about this a little bit, and I don't want to go too long, but you know how I get, the Housing Affordability Task Force report just came out. And so everybody's clear, the big headline is 1.5 million homes is going to be built, right? It's all supply side. When you dig into that, there are things in there that say, basically, if you're not a developer or the municipality, if you want to have any appeal, you're going to have to pay $10,000 just to get your foot in the door. Oh, and by the way, you're not going to be able to do as many community information sessions. Municipalities will not be allowed to have additional community engagement sessions. They are getting the idea of this NIMBY part, not saying it's right, but they are basically planning on plowing over whatever community consultation we had, because the scapegoat has become people that don't want their communities to change. That isn't necessarily accurate, but people better wise up to what they want, because it's going to get forced down your throat eventually. And I think it'd be better if we all work together on a vision versus the infighting and the, you know, the stymieing of like, no, not that either. No, it can't be that, right? We got to figure out a way together.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the task force's recommendations could serve as a topic for an entire podcast. There's a number of things that touch on what we're talking about now, including, I think there's some of the recommendations are likely to exacerbate the vertical sprawl in place of possibly in place of horizontal sprawl. And one of those things actually touches on what you were just mentioning, that strategy of presenting a building that's quite a bit taller than what they actually intend to do, because there's a recommendation that developers would be compensated for a loss of profit, basically, with respect to building like that. So, you know, they would propose a tall building. It'd come before sort of, you know, the planners would sort of refuse that, and then the municipality would be on the hook.
Yeah, potentially.
And that $10,000, I mean, just so you know, that it's an interesting document. I don't think it hangs together very well. I think a lot of the logic is flawed in it. And a good example is that the Ontario Land Tribunal, you know, that their justification for that $10,000 fee for the public to be able to participate, which is up from what, like $400, I think, is the current.
Yeah, it's only a couple amount. $100, $125 at least it was when I was involved in it, but that was ages ago.
Yeah, their justification is that there's, you know, that it would better resource the tribunal, because it's in need of resources, that there's a, you know, there's a backlog of more than 1,000 cases currently. And for one, they actually sort of justify it also because they feel like there's that the meddling, the appeals process is holding up development approvals, for one. So this barrier would significantly reduce that. But then also they say that it would better resource this tribunal. So you're looking at a significant reduction in the number of appeals. Now, of course, the amount per appeal has gone up significantly, but that's, whether that would sort of outweigh the reduction and therefore better resource the appeals tribunal. And there's other ways of resourcing, of better funding the tribunal as well, right? So why put that on the backs of citizens? I'm not a huge fan of this report, so you might be able to tell. But that's, I think we should probably leave for another episode, because we're already
We can. I would just close with, on this housing affordability thing, because I think it's really important, is that there is the populism politics that's happening within the housing conversation. And the headline of 1.5 million homes is very similar to the Buck a Beer, where it sounds like a silver bullet of we can fix all of it by this very simple policy choice, not looking into the details of one, how is that going to happen? Two, is that going to achieve anything? And three, is it actually dealing with the root causes, or are we still getting into these really oversimplified solutions? And so I would caution anybody from buying too heavily into the $1.5 million home promise, as this is going to be the thing that solves all of the housing issues that we have, because it's way more nuanced than that. And a lot of the data doesn't support most of the recommendations. And frankly, there's a lot of restrictions on public input and a lot of loosening on developer influence, which is problematic altogether. Doesn't mean that all of it's bad, but I think everyone should just be very cautious of accepting it blindly, as this is the ultimate solution here.
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately what it's saying is that the very folks who got us into this mess are the solution to it, right? So
exactly. But next month we have on Stop Sprawl Aurelia. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about community building and grassroots movements in community building and the type of efforts that are required to make our communities more equitable, more affordable, more socially cohesive. And that's going to be our next one. So we're going to be talking with Madeline Fournier, maybe some others who are behind Stop Sprawl Aurelia, and learn a little bit more. Maybe there's listeners here who want to emulate kind of the go-getting-ism. Is that a thing? I don't know if that's a thing, but it's a thing now. The go-getting-ism of Madeline in their own community.
All right. Well, looking forward to that. And you can always leave a review, and that will help increase the visibility of this podcast on the various platforms. It'd be fantastic if you do. And of course, you can support us on our website with the sort of one-off or reoccurring monthly donations. It is very, very much appreciated. And we have a Patreon for this. If you're interested, the link is in the show notes. And that is a really cheap and simple way that you can support us as well, so that you can choose sort of a buck a month, buck an episode kind of thing, which, you know, the more people that do that, the
better. Or you get to hear a rant.
Yeah.
And only bother reviewing if you liked it. If you didn't like it, just don't worry about reviewing it. But if you did like it, take a moment.
Yeah, or if you don't like it and want to leave constructive feedback, that's cool too. You know, and we're always happy to connect.
Yep.
So for now, have a great week, and we'll see you next month.
Bye-bye.